Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science. Well, just 2 weeks ago, the President of the United States was administered a drug called remdesivir, which is the only, I repeat, the only drug authorized by the Food and Drug Administration to be used to treat the effects of the coronavirus. And now there's a new study which analyzed 11,000 individuals in 30 different hospitals and countries around the world, saying, bah, humbug, there's no benefit whatsoever to remdesivir. And so then the question is, what do we have in our arsenal if you one day catch the coronavirus? What does science say about this controversy? And then, speaking about the coronavirus, what is your blood type? Do you know your blood type? That could be very important if you're in an accident and you need an emergency influx of blood. There are four types, AB, and O. And now it turns out there's a new study showing that people who have blood type O tend to be more resistant to the effects of the coronavirus. And unfortunately, scientists are clueless as to understand why blood type O seems to give you extra protection against the coronavirus. And then herd immunity once again is in the news. And people are wondering, what happens if you simply let the virus rip? Let it pervade society and get it over with? Well, we'll say a few things about the math and the statistics behind what is called herd immunity. And also on the medical front, we'll say a few things about diabetes. It turns out that diabetes affects almost 10% of the world's population, and it is potentially a horrible disease. It can cause blindness, amputation of your fingers, arms, legs. It can cause all sorts of problems with organ failure throughout the entire body. And now here's a new way to treat it, which is really an oddball way, but hey, you can't argue with the results. Using electromagnetic fields to stabilize the glucose level in your blood. So we'll talk about this new therapy, which is getting a lot of attention. It's an oddball therapy. It caught scientists totally off guard, using electromagnetic fields to stabilize glucose levels. And then we're going to soar into outer space. Elon Musk, the founder of SpaceX, has already made history. He was the first to be able to market reusable rockets, rockets that have taken private enterprise up to the International Space Station, and now he's made a formal announcement. It's Mars. That's right, Mars in 4 years' time. So write that down on your calendar. 2024, SpaceX is going to launch its mission to the red planet. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The top story that dominated headlines 2 weeks ago is the fact that President Donald Trump was administered a cocktail of three drugs. One is the monoclonal antibodies, second is remdesivir, and third is dexamethasone. And, well, it seems to work so far. We'll have to wait and see, of course. But now there's a new study coming out that analyzed 11,000 people, and they found no benefit whatsoever from remdesivir. And already this has landed right into the center of a controversy. And the controversy is that remdesivir is the only, I repeat, the only drug authorized by the Food and Drug Administration to be administered to people with the coronavirus. So what's behind this controversy? Well, first of all, let me say that this is nothing new. This is how science is done, especially in emerging science that's so controversial. Science tries to get at truth. But where does truth come from? Truth doesn't come from the sky. It comes from interaction with incorrect ideas and falsehoods. That's where truth comes from, meaning that so-called truth changes with time as we get more and more evidence. For example, Newton's laws of motion replaced the laws of Aristotle, and then Einstein's laws began to improve upon Newton's laws. And now we have the quantum theory, which gives us more corrections to Einstein's theory. So in other words, one theory supersedes a previous theory. Now remember back in December, it was announced that this new virus coming out of China, well, you didn't have to worry about it because it did not go from human to human. It went from animal to animal, not from human to human. Boy, was that wrong. That was totally a fraudulent study that came out from China back in December. And then in the early days of the pandemic, scientists said that, well, masks are not necessary. In fact, don't wear a mask because of the fact that it takes away masks from first responders and nurses. Don't wear a mask. They're not effective anyway. Boy, was that recommendation also incorrect. And then a more recent recommendation was that, well, stay 6 feet away from other people, and that should give you protection against the virus. Well, now we have a flood of studies showing that perhaps the main way in which the virus is transmitted is through aerosols, tiny, tiny microscopic droplets which contain the virus, which can spread much more than 6 feet. And so now the guidelines are being changed. Different variations of the guideline exist. But most scientists would say that, first of all, it helps to be outdoors, where aerosols can be dispersed rapidly rather than indoors. Don't be next to people that are shouting, singing, chanting, because that sprays the environment with aerosols that can go much farther than 6 feet. And limit the amount of time that you talk to somebody, because even just talking, you can emit about 1,000 particles of aerosols per minute in the air just by talking in a normal way. And so science is constantly changing as more information comes out. Now, remdesivir was given to the President of the United States. It's not a cure. The FDA didn't say it was a cure. The FDA said that it could reduce the amount of time in a hospital, in the ICU unit. Instead of 15 days, maybe only 11 days are necessary in an ICU. But that's good, because the longer you are on a ventilator, the higher the chances that you will die. In other words, 90%, up to 90% of those people who are placed on ventilators will eventually die. So if you can cut that down, you could perhaps reduce the death rate. Well, here's a new study which is beginning to upset the apple cart. This new study was done on 11,000 people in 30 different countries, showing that, well, first of all, remdesivir does not affect the death rate. But scientists already knew that. Remdesivir was advertised not as the cure-all that could reduce the death rate. It simply reduces the hospitalization time. But this new study says, bah, humbug, even that is in dispute. The conclusion of the study was they looked at many therapies, even beyond remdesivir, and they found that none of them, I repeat, none of them affected the death rate and the hospitalization rate. Zero. Well, since that report came out, scientists had a chance to read it and begin to see flaws in that report. First of all, they were done in 30 different countries. Each country has a different protocol, different ways in which to calculate death rate, hospitalization rate, but the report didn't adequately compensate for that. Second of all, they didn't have a placebo, and in fact, many of the researchers knew in advance who tested positive and who tested negative. So it was not a double-blind study. So scientists are saying, well, this report is nice. It confirmed the fact that remdesivir does not reduce the death rate, but we knew that already. but it probably does reduce the time that you spend in the ICU, which in turn could reduce suffering and save lives. Now, we should also point out that the report did not look at polyclonal antibodies. That was the new controversial drug given to President Donald Trump. In other words, we have something called convalescent plasma. That is, we take the blood of people that had the virus and recovered, extract out the plasma, and inject that plasma into the next patient. And that patient then benefits from the antibodies of the first patient who was infected previously. And this method is 100 years old. It was used back in 1918 against the Spanish flu virus at that time. And so there are problems, however, with convalescent antibodies. A person who's infected and recovered can only donate blood maybe once a week, and maybe only several times, because the body, of course, has to replenish itself, and you don't want to weaken the immune system of the person donating the plasma. Wouldn't it be better if we could simply take this plasma, take the antibodies, and clone it to give unlimited quantities of the antibodies? Well, that's where this new polyclonal antibody therapy was given to the President of the United States. It's still experimental. However, studies done on several hundred individuals have shown a remarkable response of people because they're flooded with antibodies that were synthetically multiplied in the laboratory based on antibodies of individuals or animals that had the virus and then produced antibodies against it. Not only that, but this new report done in 30 different countries did not look at dexamethasone, which is the third therapy that was given to President Donald Trump. In other words, the virus, as we keep emphasizing on this program, the virus doesn't really kill you. That's right, the virus does not really kill you. What kills you is the fact that it overexcites the immune system. The immune system goes into overdrive and basically commits suicide. In other words, you drown in your own antibody fluid. Organ failure is a result. Your lungs cease to function because the body is attacking itself. So why not use a steroid like dexamethasone, which is very cheap, costs about $1 a day. It's a very common steroid which can dampen down the response of the human body. And so there's a new protocol that's coming into play now, and that is in the early stages of hospitalization, that's when you should administer remdesivir, because that'll shorten the amount of days on a ventilator. But in late stages, when it gets very serious, and your body is undergoing the cytokine storm, as they say, and the body is overreacting and attacking itself, that's when you should administer the steroid, dexamethasone, in order to quell the immune system so that the body can get back to normal again. So in other words, the point I'm raising is something very simple, and that is you're seeing science in the making. Science is a rough and tumble field. A theory is only as good as the data. A theory, no matter how beautiful or no matter how seemingly persuasive it is, has to be able to live up to the fire of reproducible experiments. And that's what this is all about. So in other words, scientists are still believing that remdesivir can reduce the amount of time in a hospital because of defects, incompleteness, incorrect assumptions in this massive report done on 11,000 individuals. And speaking about the coronavirus, another blip on the news concerns blood type O. Now, in general, everybody should know their blood type. Let's say you're in an accident and you're bleeding heavily, and the doctors have to give you blood from another individual. You don't want the wrong blood type because it could kill you. There are four major blood types, A, B, AB, and O. Of these, the most interesting is blood type O. It is the universal donor. It is compatible with A, B, and AB. So that's why when you donate blood, the Red Cross is very much interested in extracting blood from blood donors with blood type O, because they can be used universally in emergency situations. Now it turns out that patients in Denmark, the Netherlands, and China, in fact, hundreds of thousands of records of people who come down with the coronavirus are being analyzed by scientists, and they find something very interesting. After analyzing hundreds of thousands of records, they found that people with blood type O suffered fewer infections, infections that were less severe, they spent less time in the hospital, and so blood type O, for some reason, gives you a certain amount of protection against the coronavirus. Now, of course, protection is not 100%. You can still die of the coronavirus even if you have blood type O, but it means that on average, blood type O gives you some measure of protection. So if you have blood type O, this does not mean you should go out, party, yell and scream at the disco and have a great time. No, it does not mean that at all. It means that perhaps there's a mechanism which scientists can unravel so that perhaps everyone could have the benefit of blood type O. Unfortunately, not much is known about this. We don't know that much about the coronavirus to understand why blood type O, individuals with blood type O have fewer infections, and if they have the disease, it is much less severe than those who do not have blood type O. And speaking of blood type, the whole question of herd immunity keeps popping up every now and then. So let me just say a few things about herd immunity. First of all, some people say that the virus will eventually disappear. That's right, disappear on its own. And there's a certain logic to that, believe it or not. Because, well, where do these ancient pandemics go after all? We've had them even in biblical times. They mention plagues and diseases. And in the pandemic of 1350 and 1666, a good fraction of the population of Europe died as a consequence of these plagues. And then the question is, where did the plague go? Back then, they didn't have masks. They didn't have social distancing. They didn't have the therapies that we have today. They didn't have the internet to give us information. No, it was pure panic back throughout human history. So what happened to these germs and these plagues? Well, they disappeared. But where did they go? It's thought, and again, this is a theory, that eventually it infected maybe 60, 70% of the population of Europe. And at that point, these individuals became, quote, immune. And it also meant that the virus had a harder and harder time attacking the next generation of individuals. You see, if 60 to 70% of a population is invulnerable to a virus, the virus cannot spread very well at all, and it must mutate. But according to the laws of Darwin, the virus must mutate to a milder form or else it goes extinct. So in other words, in order to survive, it has to not kill the next generation of individuals, because if it kills the next generation, it has no future. And so in the interest of self-preservation, the virus becomes milder by mutating. In other words, the Spanish flu virus of 1918 is still around. That's right. It's all around us. It's one of the variations of the flu, except it's mutated to the point where it's not causing a tremendous pandemic. Now, you may say to yourself, well, why not always rely on herd immunity? Well, the problem is that you have to pay a price. And that is, you have to infect perhaps 60, 70% of the population and then do a little bit of calculus. It turns out that the coronavirus will kill about 1% of those that are infected. This is an approximate number. The ordinary flu, for example, will kill 0.1% or 1/10 the fatality rate of the coronavirus. So let's say the population of the United States is 300 million. And let's say that, 50% are infected just by letting it rip. That means 150 million people get infected, of which 1% die, meaning that you have 1.5 million people who must die in order to attain herd immunity. Now, there is another way to attain herd immunity, and this is with the vaccine. So either vaccination or the natural infection of the entire population can allow you to reach herd immunity. So what's the catch? In other words, a country like the United States must sacrifice about 1.5 million people in order to attain herd immunity. So, that's a medical and political question. Are we willing to sacrifice that chunk of the American population? Also, good news on the diabetic front. People with type 2 diabetes have a very painful love-hate relationship with that disease. You have to prick your finger. You have to analyze the glucose level, because if you don't, perhaps one day the capillaries in your fingers and your retina will degenerate, meaning they'll have to amputate your fingers, your legs and arms, and blindness could result and organ failure as well. A horrible way to go. And now there's a new study that seems to just come out of the blue. It's from the University of Iowa, showing that static electromagnetic fields may stabilize glucose levels. Amazing. Who would have thought? Now, the magnetic fields are harmless, about 100 times the Earth's static magnetic field. And given to mice overnight, it'll stabilize their glucose levels. So who knows? Maybe in the future at some point, people will simply sleep and expose themselves to a static, harmless electromagnetic field, maybe 100 times the Earth's magnetic field, and stabilize their glucose level without having to prick a finger, without having to invade the biochemistry of your body. Wouldn't that be great? And also in the news, Mars is in the news because Elon Musk, the gadfly behind SpaceX, the billionaire visionary, has a new plan to reach Mars in 4 years. That's right, the unmanned mission to the red planet, backed by the billionaire Elon Musk. Now, he's known for two things. First of all, he's known for making unrealistic predictions. Second of all, he makes world history when he achieves a fraction of these incredible visionary predictions. He sponsored the reusable rocket, which is now one of the backbones of the space mission. He had the first commercial mission to the space station. And now he wants to have tourists go to the moon in 3 years. That's right, tourists. Tourists paying money to visit the moon in 3 years. And in 4 years, he wants his rocket called the Starship to have an unmanned mission to the red planet. We should point out that he has a goal. He has a mission in mind. When he was a child, he read the book Foundation by Isaac Asimov. I read it. A whole generation of young people have been inspired by that book because it talks about a multi-planet species. It talks about the time when humanity has spread throughout the galaxy. That humanity is so old, in fact, that it has pretty much forgotten where the Earth is located. That's how old humanity is. The book is set about 50,000 years into the future, when we have something similar to warp drive, and we're able to colonize a good chunk of the galaxy. Now, why would we want to do that? Well, among other reasons, the dinosaurs did not have a space program. And that's why they're not here today to argue the point. They got wiped out 65 million years ago by a meteor or a comet, and they did not have the technology to deflect it. Well, we do have a space program, and as an insurance policy, Elon Musk wants to become part of a two-planet species so that if something bad were to happen to the planet Earth, there's a backup plan someplace else. And so, in other words, we're talking about a mission. Now, back in the 60s, the mission was beat the Russians, beat the Russians. Well, we did it. We beat the Russians. And then we lost interest because there was no larger vision, no larger goal in mind. Well, that's where Elon Musk says, well, he has a vision. And that vision is from Isaac Asimov, that humanity should become a multi-planet species, which means you have to have a transportation system. And that's where his Starship comes in. SpaceX has a new booster rocket, the Starship, which is capable of going to Mars and even beyond. That's right, it's even capable. That's right, Elon Musk envisions his Starship rocket to be the backbone for an interplanetary transit system. That's right, think of it, a booster rocket capable of easily going between the different planets of the solar system. That's the vision of Elon Musk and SpaceX. Well, time will tell whether, once again, he's been shooting off the mouth, or maybe he's on to something which can change the destiny of the human race. Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about eternity. That is it possible to become immortal? Is it possible that one day we'll be able to stop the aging process and live forever, like in fairy tales and biblical texts? Think about that. The ability of genetics and maybe even digital technology to make us live forever. With us in the second half of Exploration is Dr. Jay Olshansky, author of the book, The Quest for Immortality. And we're going to separate the fiction from the science concerning the aging process and whether it's possible to live forever. And now I'd like to bring on our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Professor S.J. Olshansky. He's a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and he's also a research institute at the Center on Aging at the University of Chicago. Well, if you've been to the drugstore, you've probably been hit with all these advertising saying that you can retard the aging process, even roll back the hands of time, live longer, they say. But what about the truth? The truth about human growth hormone, antioxidants, massive doses of vitamins and minerals and herbs and supplements? What about the hardcore truth and scientific verification of these claims? And also, what about genetics? We seem to be teasing apart many of the genes that influence the aging process. So once again, we're going to bring on our special guest today, Professor Jay Olshansky, and he's the co-author of a book called The Quest for Immortality. So that's the subject of today's discussion, immortality. I understand that today you and other prominent scientists have issued a policy statement, a recommendation of sorts that could have serious and beneficial economic benefits. Could you elaborate?
Yes. This is based on an article we published in The Scientist back in March of this year with Rich Miller from the University of Michigan, Dan Perry from the Alliance for Aging Research, and Bob Butler from the International Longevity Center in New York. And we basically suggested that the time has arrived for societies, not just the United States, but really all nations, to begin investing in an effort to slow the biological process of aging in people. And the logic and the rationale is fairly straightforward. Basically, what we're suggesting is that even a small deceleration or slowdown in the rate of biological aging of just a few years would actually yield huge economic and health benefits. I mean, think of it this way. The way the NIH is currently set up is essentially to deal with one disease at a time, independent of all others. But if you can find a way to slow down the biological process of aging, you would essentially postpone everything that is negative associated with growing older into later and later ages. It would be as if you achieved a major discovery for every major fatal and non-fatal disease if you could find a way to slow aging. So we're calling on Congress to begin investing in a concerted effort to slow the biological process of aging in people.
Yes, in fact, the social benefits could be astronomical, especially as you look at the baby boomers that are hitting 60 and will eventually increase medical costs tremendously in this country.
Yes, I mean, the prevalence of conditions of frailty and disability will rise dramatically in the coming decades with the aging of the baby boom cohort. So slowing that process even a little bit would actually enable people to be healthier longer, contribute to the economy longer. They would just everything positive associated with aging. There are positive things associated with aging. Would be extended. So it would be an extraordinarily important event for national economies, for public health. The time has arrived, I think. And not only has the time arrived, but the science is approaching the level at which I think we're beginning to gain enough understanding that we think we can do this in humans. We know we can do it in other animals. We think we can do this in humans.
Okay, now let's get back to Earth and talk about hokum, snake oil, and real science. If you visit the drugstore, you realize that there are whole shelves full of herbs and remedies and vitamins, making all sorts of promises about retarding the aging process, reversing the years. So let's now talk about the science, that is, what is known experimentally. Let's start with the internet, where we have lots of advertisements for human growth hormone. Now, in some sense, are the people of America being used as guinea pigs for this gigantic experiment on human growth hormone, or what are your thoughts?
Well, people are using themselves as guinea pigs. It's absolutely remarkable that, you can go on the internet and find every conceivable nutritional supplement and hormone, including growth hormone, with people with no expertise in the field claiming that it can slow, stop, or reverse the biological process of aging. And people believe this. They spend enormous sums of money. They order this stuff over the internet. They inject themselves with it or take these pills. And there isn't a shred of evidence that it'll make you live any longer. There actually is some suggestive evidence that some of these substances, including growth hormone, have the potential to actually shorten your life. So it's remarkable that people are conducting a biological experiment on themselves. It doesn't mean that there isn't value necessarily to some nutritional supplements, particularly for people who are deficient in certain vitamins and minerals. There's no question that there is a benefit for those individuals. But if your diet is so bad that you're deficient in some major vitamin or mineral or something, these vitamin supplements aren't going to make up the difference. It simply isn't going to work. And there's no evidence that it actually extends life.
And what about the side effects of human growth hormones? Some people think maybe cancer or other kinds of diseases associated with accelerating metabolism. It's like a sports car. If you were to accelerate a sports car, you throw off a few gears here and there. And that, of course, means cancer, because cancer, in some sense, is genetic errors. But what are your thoughts about side effects of human growth hormone?
Well, first of all, it has been demonstrated that there are some benefits, believe it or not, associated with growth hormone, including increased muscle mass and reduction in the rate of bone loss and improved skin elasticity. So you can't deny the fact that there have been benefits associated with it. But accompanying those benefits have been risks, including carpal tunnel syndrome, increased risk of diabetes. There is suggestive evidence that it might increase the risk of cancer. The fact is that it hasn't been properly studied yet using clinical trials in humans. And so before those clinical trials are in, before we know what the results are, it's really premature to be using these kinds of substances. And again, once again, with the case of growth hormone, there isn't any evidence that it extends life.
Okay, now moving on, when you go to the drugstore, you see these advertisements for mega vitamins. Some claim that it retards the oxidation process. Other people cite certain studies which show that if you ingest certain diets rich in vitamins, it seems to be good for you. But what about the pure form of vitamins that you buy in the drugstore?
Well, once again, the nutritional supplement industry is really working hard to convince us that aging is somehow caused by either the loss of some hormone or the lack of nutritional supplements of one kind or another, and they're perfectly willing to sell you everything that they can to try to convince you that you can somehow influence this process. And it's based in part on science, where it's suggested that aging is influenced by oxidation, and this oxidation process can be slowed down in theory with the ingestion of certain nutritional supplements that have antioxidative effects. But there isn't any empirical evidence that demonstrates that these substances actually extend duration of life. So once again, it's the same scenario where people are selling something with exaggerated claims, with a profit motive in mind, and people are buying it up like crazy.
And what about herbs? Some people say that maybe pure vitamins that are refined by the chemical companies may not simulate vitamins in the natural forms. So what about taking herbal medicines? What is known or not known about herbs?
Now, honestly, I don't know that much about herbs and herbal medicines to comment on that. But what I can tell you is that there's plenty of evidence that eating more fruits and vegetables and can certainly lower your risk of a wide variety of diseases and disorders. And, of course, those in the supplement industry are suggesting that contained within those fruits and vegetables there are certain substances that they can concentrate in a pill and give to you in a larger form, you know, under the assumption that more is better. Well, there is where the evidence is lacking. The evidence is there that eating more fruits and vegetables is good for you. The evidence is lacking that the nutritional supplements containing the vitamins that they think are causing the beneficial effect, the evidence there is lacking that that will have any significant effect.
Okay, now moving on, let's talk about something that actually does work. I think all scientists would say unanimously that there is one and only one proven way, in the animal kingdom anyway, of actually increasing the lifespan of animals. We don't know whether it works for humans yet. But let's talk about caloric restriction. First of all, what is it, and what tests have been done?
Well, you're right. This is the one intervention that's been demonstrated repeatedly to extend duration of life on a wide variety of species. It's basically reducing your caloric intake. It can, you know, vary. The percentage can vary from anywhere from 10 to 30% below maintenance levels. So it would depend on what your current height and weight is, but you know, if your normal caloric intake is 2,000 calories to maintain your weight, you might be reducing it down to 1,500 calories. And no one exactly knows why it works or how it works, the underlying mechanism, but there is consistent research suggesting that it extends duration of life. Now, the question is, how does it do so? Does it extend duration of life by slowing the biological process of aging? Some people believe that to be the case. Others suggest that it actually extends duration of life by reducing the risk of a wide variety of diseases and disorders, which is not the same as slowing the biological process of aging. Remember, if you reduce the risk of heart disease, cancer, and stroke, however you do that, through exercise or diet, the aging process marches on. It's uninfluenced by that. But if indeed you're slowing down the biological process of aging, then everything negative associated with it is dragged to later ages. It's postponed to later ages. And that would actually be a wonderful thing if caloric restriction was the mechanism that actually worked. Now, don't expect, by the way, that people are going to be living longer by dramatically reducing their caloric intake. What the scientists are looking for is the underlying mechanism to find a way to mimic that process without actually reducing your caloric intake. It should be obvious, by the way, that in the United States and elsewhere, we're doing the exact opposite. We are increasing our caloric intake. We are growing more obese at a more rapid pace than we ever have in the past. So this research is particularly important and is interesting for a wide variety of reasons.
Okay, now caloric restriction works on yeast cells, spiders, insects, mice, and now for the first time we're getting the first preliminary evidence from primate studies done in Bethesda, Maryland. So can you tell us a little bit about some of those experiments, because primates, of course, are closer to us, and perhaps it may work on organisms as complex as us. But what are your thoughts?
Well, my guess is it probably will. I mean, the work of Richard Weinrich from Wisconsin and other researchers at NIH Bethesda have, I think, demonstrated quite convincingly that reducing caloric intake can lower the risk of disease. Probably it will extend duration of life. We have to wait for these animals to live long enough to determine whether or not that's going to be one of the consequences. But there are a couple of problems here. In some of the earlier studies, you need to remember that the control animals that were used in the caloric restriction studies were fed ad libitum, meaning they had as much food as they wanted, which is sort of like us. And so whenever you reduce your caloric intake relative to eating as much as you want, what you are demonstrating is more the detrimental effect of a gluttonous lifestyle rather than the longevity-enhancing effect of caloric restriction. So you have to be careful on how you interpret that. Now, in more recent studies, the control animals are not fed ad libitum. They are fed really more of a maintenance diet. And you're not seeing quite the large differences in duration of life in these two populations when you do it that way. Nevertheless, you do see reductions in the risk of a wide variety of diseases and disorders, and we would all be better off if we reduced our caloric intake. Whether it would work in humans at the level that we see in these other species, I think, is highly questionable. And there's a real concern when, for example, you extend the duration of life of a fruit fly or a roundworm nematode by 3, 4, or 5-fold, it's real tempting for researchers to then multiply the human life expectancy by 3, 4, or 5 and suggest that the same effect, if it occurred in humans, would make us live hundreds and hundreds of years. My guess is we wouldn't see anywhere near that kind of increase in magnitude and duration of life in humans. But if we could, you know, live healthier longer for just, you know, an extra 5 or 10 years, that would be huge.
Okay, now I understand that the animals that have been studied seem to be a little bit lethargic because they have such a restricted diet. They have less cancerous tumors, less incidences of diseases associated with the aging process, but they also seem to lack an interest in the sex drive. That is, all the things that make life worth living, joie de vivre, these animals seem to be pretty lethargic. Is that true?
Yeah, so I understand that there appears to be a price to pay. There appears to be lower fecundity, less interest in sex, and I think a difficult problem with controlling body temperature. These animals are cold, in fact, feel cold. And in fact, in the case of humans who are conducting this experiment on themselves, they're essentially reporting the same thing. So there is a price, at least for now to be paid by adopting this calorically restricted diet, which is why, as I suggested earlier, reducing your caloric intake to these kinds of levels probably isn't the way it's going to work in humans. The way it's probably going to work in humans is that scientists will try to find some sort of mimetic, something that will fool the body into believing that it's calorically restricted to achieve the same effect without actually significantly reducing your caloric intake like that. And that's probably the way it will work. And that's it's extremely valuable and interesting research that needs to be aggressively pursued because there's such great potential there.
Okay, now let's leave the animal kingdom and talk strictly about humans. In your book, you mentioned the fact that the life expectancy for Americans at the beginning of the 20th century was not very long at all, less than 50 years of age. And yet there's been an increase into the 70s since then. Some people think it's sanitation. Other people think it's antibiotics and vaccines. But what are your thoughts about looking at the long-term life expectancy of humans going back to ancient days, through the Middle Ages, to the turn of the century, to present-day times?
Well, going back to ancient times, there's evidence to suggest that life expectancy, for example, during the time of the ancient Egyptians, was probably somewhere in the 20s. Nobody knows exactly where it was, but it's likely to have been in the 20s. We achieved a very small incremental increase over the millennia to the beginning of the 19th and 20th centuries, when life expectancy rose up to about between 45 and 50, in the United States anyway. And then you saw this quantum leap in life expectancy during the 20th century from 50 to close to 80. And that was largely attributable to dramatic reductions in early age mortality, infant, child, and maternal mortality, principally as a result of sanitation, public health, refrigeration, foods, and so forth. It's, you know, the introduction of antibiotics occurred after most of the declines in the death rates occurred at younger ages and contributed relatively a small amount to the rise in life expectancy in the 20th century. Now, in the latter part of the 20th century, there have been notable reductions in death rates at middle and older ages, even from heart disease, from some forms of cancer. And so you see, you know, two forces contributing during the 20th century, the early age mortality declines at the beginning and the later age mortality declines at the end, which explains, by the way, why the more recent increases in life expectancy have been smaller than the ones that occurred at the beginning of the 20th century. When you save children from dying, you add very rapidly to life expectancy. When you save middle-aged and older people from dying from fatal diseases, chronic fatal diseases, you add a relatively smaller amount.
Now, it turns out that Japanese women have some of the longest life expectancies on the planet Earth. It's almost approaching 90. So we're talking about 50% of Japanese women essentially getting into their late 80s and into their 90s. Some people say it's diet, a fish diet that's low in fat. But what are your thoughts about the demographics of different societies?
Well, first of all, for Japanese women, it's just above 85. It might be approaching 86. And, mm-hmm. and you have to realize that there's a huge difference between 85 and 90. It's not the same as between 50 and 55. And the reason is fairly straightforward. To raise life expectancy up when you're at these very high levels is extremely difficult because you're pushing up against the basic biological process of aging itself. There's no question that subgroups of the population, such as those in Okinawa, Japan, for example, have much higher life expectancies. The actual force involved is not yet understood. It's not like we can, here in the U.S., adopt the lifestyle of the Japanese. I know some people have suggested this, including some friends of mine who study the Okinawa diet, suggested that you can somehow get Americans to live as long as the Okinawans by adopting this particular lifestyle. And there's no evidence to suggest that that would be the case, unless, of course, we were all Japanese here in the United States, and that isn't the case. There are genetic factors that are influencing the risk of death and duration of life, and those are things that we simply cannot control, at least not yet, anyway. But there's no question that subgroups of the population do experience greater longevity than other subgroups, and that is a fascinating area to study, by the way, because it would appear as though there are genes that exist within the human genome that influence duration of life, and they may be more highly concentrated in some subgroups relative to others.
Okay, now let's talk about genes, because that's, of course, where most of the breakthroughs are being made in the last few years. Again, there's no fountain of youth. No one in the genetics area is claiming to have solved the aging process, but there's been lots of very interesting studies. First of all, there's something called progeria, a genetic disease that's been intensely studied, in which children die of old age. They look like plucked chickens, and they die of heart attacks as teenagers. Could you elaborate on that very strange disease?
Well, it appears on this, progeria appears on the surface anyway to be a phenomenon of accelerated aging, but there's evidence to suggest it is not. There are lots of things that don't occur in these children that occur in the aging phenotype of individuals who actually do make it out to older ages. So I would be cautious about thinking of progeria as accelerated aging. It is certainly interesting to study these individuals, and you have to realize that it's always easy to do something to yourself that will accelerate aging. I mean, you know, we do it all the time, quite frankly. And one of my the arguments that I've made for many years is that the only control we have over the duration of our life is to shorten it. And we exercise that control all the time when we adopt lifestyles that are, where we expose ourselves to the sun, or we don't exercise, or we smoke cigarettes, or use drugs. These are the kinds of things that can make us die at much younger ages than would otherwise be the case.
And that concludes our interview with Dr. Jay Olshansky, author of a new book called The Quest for Immortality. Now, I would be remiss unless I mentioned that there was another type of immortality. We talked about organic, biological, genetic immortality, but there's also something called digital immortality. Already in Silicon Valley, there's a company offering to digitize your digital fingerprint, everything known about you, your emails, your credit ratings, your digital searches, everything that's known about you can be digitized and will live forever on the internet. And maybe in the future, when you go to the library, instead of checking a book out about Winston Churchill, you will talk to Winston Churchill. Every speech, every book, everything that he's ever done could be digitized and put on a holographic screen with a little bit of artificial intelligence to animate Winston Churchill. And for that matter, I would love to speak to Einstein. One day, I'm sure, somebody will digitize everything known about Albert Einstein, including his personality quirks, his voice, his musings, his thoughts. I would love to sit down and talk to Albert Einstein. And for that matter, maybe one day you will be digitized as well. Maybe your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandkids will wonder who their ancestor was so many generations ago. You know, today, when you check your genealogy, eventually you hit a dead end. Eventually you realize that your ancestors left only two markings of their existence: in a church, their birth date, and their death date. And that's it. That's everything known about this relative, this ancestor of yours. Because back then, there was no digital revolution. Well, today, think of all the emails, think of all the photographs, think of all the things you put on the internet, which can be digitized, put into a form, and then given the blessing of digital immortality. This could actually be a practical implication. Let's say you digitize yourself and put yourself, your personality, all your quirks, your voice, your thoughts, in an avatar that could live on a distant planet. and roam the galaxy. You wouldn't have to worry about weightlessness and media impacts. No, your personality would be free to roam around Mars or anywhere you want. Or for that matter, let's say you're digitized and you're placed on a laser beam. I call this laser porting. One day we may shoot our entire consciousness, digitized consciousness, into outer space on a laser beam. It'll be downloaded, for example, on the moon. It'll only take about 1 second to reach the moon. It'll be downloaded and then put into an avatar, an immortal, superhuman avatar, that'll then begin to wander around the moon, Mars, the planets, the universe. Think about that. Exploring the universe as an immortal at the speed of light. In 20 minutes, you're on Mars. In 8 hours or so, you're on Pluto. And in 4 years, you could be on the nearest star system. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if already this exists. Maybe aliens from outer space have already decided that this is the most economical, efficient way to explore the galaxy. And they have a laser highway shooting the souls, the digitized souls of billions of people throughout the universe. Think about that. This may already exist. Well, unfortunately, our time is up. Once again, you've been listening to an interview with Dr. Jay Olshansky, author of the book, The Quest for Immortality. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Once again, for a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration. Join us every week when we discuss the cutting edge of science and how it impacts on society. Good day.